You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Hi, and welcome to The Exchange. I'm Kelly Evans. Here's what's ahead this hour. A debt deal within reach. Wall Street getting more optimistic. You should see the market that we're getting closer. Dow's up more than 300 points. A two-year agreement is reportedly on the table. We'll look at the actual terms and the trades that could benefit. Plus, strike one for the Doves. The latest inflation report coming in hotter than expected. Could corporate profits be part of the problem? It's a hot button debate, and you know we're having it. And call it the week, AI got real. NVIDIA's big beat cementing the narrative, but can the tech rally keep going? One of our guests says yes, actually more than one of them. But he's got one part of the sector in particular and one name that stands out. We'll tell you which one. First, though, let's get the scoop over here with Dom Chu.
I mean, we're at close to session highs. And Kelly, just to kind of put it in context for you and the viewers out there, we had a big move higher yesterday, but you take technology bullishness and you couple it with debt ceiling optimism, and you get an even bigger move today than you got with NVIDIA's driving the action yesterday. Now, the Dow Industrials, as Kelly points out, 310 points to the upside, 33,075, 1% gains there. Even better for the broader-based S&P 500, which is now above, back above 4,200, 4,203, 52 points to the upside, 1.25% gains. At the highs of the session, we were up just near where we are now, roughly 55, 56 points, up 5 points at the lows. It's been a positive day so far. And the real outperformer, as it was yesterday, with the bullishness around NVIDIA, NASDAQ Composite up 273 points, 2% gains there, 12,970. If you take a look at one of the parts of the market that's getting a little bit more attention, we were wrapping up a couple weeks worth of retail earnings reports. What's been a mixed picture overall today for the retail space? RH, the company formerly known as Restoration Hardware, beats earnings estimates and revenue estimates, but some concerns about its current quarter, including the possibility of more markdowns to move inventory, that has those shares down 3%. Ulta Beauty also beat for the profits, beat for the revenues, but the outlook is, especially in terms of margins, dragging that stock down about 12%. Meanwhile, Gap stores, I'll tell you, it was mixed. Profits were better, revenues maybe a slight miss, but their profit margins were improving because of fewer markdowns. Gap is up about 11% in trading. That's the retail roundup. And then we spoke about the NVIDIA trade yesterday. We're seeing a similar, if not better, percentage move in another chip stock that's coupled with an AI narrative, and that's Marvell Technology up 28%. Kelly, better than expected earnings report, but it's the outlook for the rest of the year. The revenue growth, says CEO Matt Murphy, will be driven by, guess what, Kelly? Artificial intelligence. I'll send things back over to you.
Monster run there, Dom. Thank you very much. Just 6 days to go before the nation faces the threat of debt default, but negotiators may be closing in on a compromise to raise the debt ceiling. Kayla Tausche at the White House, and maybe it's going to be surprisingly drama-free. Kayla, I don't know.
Well, don't jinx it, Kelly. They're getting closer to a deal, but one Republican negotiator told reporters in the Capitol this morning the leaks are not helping, the issues are thornier, and that they're not just trying to hit one number. They're trying to change the trajectory of spending in this country. Here's House Speaker Kevin McCarthy describing his take just moments ago.
We know it's not easy, but we're going to make sure we're not just trying to get an agreement. We're trying to get something that's worthy of the American people that changes the trajectory. So we're going to work just as hard. We worked through the night last night. I thought we made progress yesterday. I want to make progress again today, and I want to be able to solve this problem.
The time frame for a deal and the overall spending levels remain critical sticking points, according to sources who note that nothing's agreed to until everything's agreed to. But some elements that are coming into focus, according to Democratic sources, the deal is expected to see two-year budget caps on non-defense discretionary spending, but higher defense spending. COVID aid would be clawed back, as would some funding for the IRS, and discussions on work requirements for aid programs and new permitting reforms are still ongoing. Both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue are huddled with their respective teams today, and it's unclear whether or when they could meet to finalize any potential deal, with sources acknowledging talks could slip into the weekend, although today is still the goal. Kelly?
Kayla, real quickly, because I know you've said and others have emphasized the 72-hour, I mean, like you had said yesterday, today kind of is the deadline. So just remind me, is the time frame still intact for Congress to rush this through or to kind of do it at a, we'll call it, normal pace? Where are we?
Well, it really depends on what House Speaker Kevin McCarthy wants to do. He has made a pledge to his conference that he would give them 72 full hours and nothing less to read the text of any bill. And it takes about a day to write a bill from any agreement in principle that's reached. Now, he could choose to shorten that time frame. He did so for the Limit, Save, Grow Act that House Republicans passed at the end of April. But that decision will be up to him. And he's made the pledge so far multiple times publicly. And it remains to be seen whether he'd bend on that, Kelly.
All right, Kayla, thank you very much. Kayla Tausche at the White House. My next guest says there's an 80% chance of a deal by the June 1 deadline. You know, deadline. Maybe it's a deadline. We don't know. But it will be a full-fledged agreement, he says, and not just a short-term extension. Joining me again is Alec Phillips. He's chief U.S. political economist at Goldman Sachs. It's good to see you, Alec. You've been pretty constructive all along here. So what's different this time?
Well, you know, I think what's different this time, at least compared to 2011 and some of the other, you know, really messy debt limit deadlines, is that, and Kayla said this, you know, they're not trying to hit a number. There's not a specific number they're trying to hit. They're just trying to basically get something that looks like they're doing enough to justify raising the debt limit for 2 years. At least that's, you know, I think the view of some anyway. We can kind of see where this is headed, and it looks like it's headed basically toward something that, you know, probably would have happened, at least most of it would have happened anyway, which is essentially flat-ish spending next year. And then, you know, we'll get a cap probably for another year after that, maybe some other policy changes, which are important. But ultimately, you know, from a macro perspective, it doesn't feel like this is that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as far as the timing goes, you said it. I mean, June 1st, it's the deadline. It's not clear that it is really the deadline. But I also think the odds are pretty good that they, you know, that they basically hit that deadline.
We're showing it here. It looks like you think maybe a hit to GDP, a drag of maybe 0.1 to 0.5 is that for 2024? Just kind of walk us through how much austerity would be included in this agreement compared with the one we had a decade ago.
Right. So the decade ago agreement, if you go back and look at that, it basically would have cut spending, capped spending, by an average of 1.1% of GDP over the next 10 years. This time around, the starting position, so the Limit, Save, Grow Act, would have cut spending by about 0.5% of GDP over the next 10 years in terms of that same spending cap. And it looks like, you know, the final deal here might be a tenth of a percent of GDP. So it's really, you know, pretty small. It doesn't mean it's not worth doing, but it basically, I think, is similar to what we would have gotten, which is, you know, flattish spending. I will say the one thing I'm a little bit surprised by, at least, you know, based on the media reports, is that the cap is only 2 years. It's a practical solution because after a couple of years, we saw even back during the 2011 budget caps, they ended up changing them anyway. So it's, you know, I think it's reasonable. But with that said, it's a little bit surprising that we've gone through all of this to basically get something that's probably not, you know, that much different from what we would have gotten just through a normal spending deal ahead of the next fiscal year.
Why isn't there a bigger push for more austerity when the debt to GDP has doubled in this country compared with financial crisis? You know, interest service, debt servicing costs have exploded as a percentage of GDP to kind of multi-decade highs. And yet we absolutely don't see the same kind of broad galvanizing push for spending cuts. And we should also point out the last time that one came like 3 years after that recession. What do you think explains that difference? And when do you think it's this year, maybe further in the future, when, you know, bigger spending cuts become a bigger political sort of move or tactic?
So, you know, I think if you go back and look at the mid-90s when we had a messy debt limit increase, or 2011, same thing, you had a couple of things that are, you know, very similar. So you had a newly Republican majority House coming into power with the Democratic Senate. You had an increase in the level of public debt. You had, at least in the 90s, you had also a pretty substantial interest expense. And so there are a lot of similarities. But the difference, I mean, I'd point out two differences. One is that public focus on fiscal issues right now is just really low.
Right.
So if you look back to those previous episodes, you had between, you know, 15 and 25% of the public saying that it was their most important political problem to solve. This, you know, right now it's like 3%. And then you also look at the situation in 2011 with the debt limit itself. So they were trying to raise the debt limit by a specific dollar amount. At that point, it was $2.1 trillion. And so they were trying to come up with the same amount of savings, $2.1 trillion. And that's what they ultimately did. This time around, they're not raising the debt limit by a dollar amount. They're just going to probably suspend it for 2 years. And if they do that, then you don't actually have to hit that specific dollar amount on the other side in terms of budget savings.
Really interesting points. And I guess just a final observation is, why don't you think there is such interest in austerity? Is it just that we haven't really felt the full impact of, you know, the crowding out that may still be to come from higher rates? I'm just curious.
So, you know, I think that there will be more of a focus once you get interest expense as a share of the economy up to, you know, 3 to 4%, which is bound to happen, I think, as we get toward the end of this decade. And I think there will also be more focus when you start to see projections of things like the Medicare and Social Security trust funds going bankrupt, which right now are projected sort of around the end of this decade. But in the meantime, I think, you know, basically what we've seen is that for the last 20 or 30 years, you had all of these warnings about the dangers of budget deficits and the dangers of high debt. And here we are with around 100% GDP debt ratio. And I think people are sort of feeling like maybe those warnings were a little bit exaggerated. So
I totally agree.
That's the basic difference between now and where we were before.
Yeah, and even all those people who have warned over the years about it may yet become a much bigger crisis. But for now, all the warnings is like the boy who cried wolf. It's fascinating. We're in such a worse position now, and yet it seems to be much less of a crisis. Alec, thanks for your time today.
Thanks.
Alec Phillips with Goldman Sachs. So if we do get the two-year deal, how do you play it? My next guest brings two names he sees well-positioned to get a short-term bounce and two names for the long haul that are bargain buys, he says, where the time to get in is now. Let's welcome in Andrew Sliman. He's Senior Portfolio Manager at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. Good to see you, Andrew. And let's just get right to it. What are the two names you think are immediate beneficiaries?
Well, from a debt deal, look, I think the cyclical value names have really been hit hard. The breadth has been, as we all know, been very narrow. And I think if you get a debt deal, there is some thought that, you know, some of the spending that was people were worried would go away is not. And so a stock like United Rentals, which is very involved in heavy infrastructure spending, you get a debt deal, I think that stock bounced back, not to mention they have an analyst meeting next Wednesday. So that's the type of stock I think is interesting. And then CRH is a building material, rocks, which again will benefit from a debt deal. And then they also have a catalyst, which is an Irish company that is relisting in the U.S. This fall. And the differential between U.S. Aggregate companies' valuation and Irish is huge. And so there's upside to that as well.
Real quickly on these two, because I want to move on to your more kind of semi-names, but are these names that directly benefit from something related to the debt deal or just removing that overhang as a catalyst?
Removing the overhang, I think a lot of cyclical stocks have been hit hard. And I on the debt deal, I noticed that, and you know this too, every day that it looks like we might get a debt deal, the breadth widens for the market, and that's when these stocks participate. So I think there are catalysts, these stocks, but no doubt their businesses are strong, assuming we get a debt deal.
Okay, got it. Let's move on then to some of the names that you think might be, you know, wins in the longer run and I hate using words like expensive or cheap. I want you to do that.
Yes,
but,
sure.
But you say they're cheap, and honestly, they do trade below 20 times, and we're talking about potentially huge tailwinds here. So without further ado, over to you.
Well, on the one hand, I hear people say, oh, I like NVIDIA at their very high multiple. And then I hear them say, well, I'm worried about China invading Taiwan. Well, guess who makes NVIDIA's AI data center chips? Largely Taiwan Semiconductor. So they are they're bound together. And so I think, you can't like NVIDIA if you don't like Taiwan Semi. If you're worried about its potential invasion, I don't think you can like NVIDIA at this juncture. So I think Taiwan Semi is in a very good spot. It is down still significantly from where it traded 2 years ago. And I think that's a very good play. And then I just think that semiconductor equipment, Applied Materials is another name, again, down from where it was 2 years ago. There will be other chip companies in the AI race, and I think you want exposure to that. So I think this is the semiconductor area is simply a cheaper way to play this explosion in AI.
Sure. No, those valuations are still so reasonable. It's almost shocking.
Sure.
When people say, and I've seen the comments going around, that this is a bear market bounce and, you know, outside of this area, you know, the market is acting poorly and kind of in some ways resembling the market peak in 2000. What is your response to that? Do you agree?
Sure. So, look, first of all, I would request whenever anyone says the breadth is poor, always ask them, does that always lead to a market going down, or are you only remembering 2000? Because the data suggests that actually Mark's narrow breadth sometimes leads to the market to go down, but a lot of times it actually broadens out and leads to the market to go up. But we all remember 2000, which was narrow breadth led to the market going down. So we kind of anchor to that data. So I just think that eventually all this cash is going to have to find its way back into the market. I think it's too early, but I think it's going to happen this fall, and people will be searching for names that haven't participated. So I expect the breadth will widen, not lead to a bear market.
I remember your bullishness a couple months ago on this show, and I was like, I don't know. And here we are. So happy vibes. Andrew, thanks so much for coming back on today. We appreciate it.
Take care.
Andrew Sliman with Morgan Stanley Investment Management. Coming up, we'll hit NVIDIA. It's in the green again today, building on yesterday's 24% gain. Not even taking a breath here. But it's not the only chip maker seeing huge post-earnings move. Will this week go down as the one when AI became real to the market or when the bubble started blowing? That's ahead in today's Tech Check. But first, we'll revisit the age-old debate. What's driving inflation? Is it corporate profits or just plain old supply and demand? Our next guests are pulling off the gloves. Dow's up 283. Welcome back to The Exchange. This morning's PCE inflation, the Fed's preferred measure, coming in higher than expected. So is that strike one for the doves ahead of next month's Fed meeting? Let's get to Steve Leisman with a closer look. Steve?
Doesn't bother you, Kelly? We got the birds playing baseball here. I guess I'm responsible for that somewhat, at least.
You are.
Anyway, we got one of three key economic reports before next month's meeting, and it was a whiff for the doves, or a swing and a miss, as you will. Inflation coming in higher than expected, backing up the concern of several Fed officials who have recently expressed concern that inflation is not falling fast enough. No matter how you slice it, the inflation index for consumer spending, the Fed's preferred inflation indicator for April, was up and remains far above the 2% target. Headline PCE 4.36%, up 17 bips. Core PCE up 7 bips. All of that and the core PCE ex housing, which is the one Powell's been looking at a lot, up 0.9. Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester wouldn't prejudge the outcome of the Fed's mid-June meeting, but made clear the data suggests to her the Fed is not yet where it needs to be when it comes to a peak funds rate.
The way I view it is I would like to get to a point in the funds rate where I feel that whatever the next move is, and whenever that is, it's about equally weighted between an up move and a down move. And given the data that we've had so far, I don't think we're at that level yet.
All right, what's more, durable goods and consumer spending suggested the economy accelerated from the first quarter, and several forecasters boosted their GDP forecast for the quarter. What's left before that June meeting? You have the payroll report June 2nd, CPI report June 13th. So that's two more tries at the plate there. And then the unknowns, of course, the debt ceiling outcome and bank lending stressors could perhaps cause the Fed to pause, depending upon how those work out. The good news, hey, the consumer refuses to quit here, and so far, so has business spending. Bad news, the Fed clearly wants to see both being softer and a softer economy. And Kelly, seems likely to keep hiking until it gets it.
I don't know. June 13th is when the next CPI comes out, and it's going to be 4.1%, according to the Cleveland Fed nowcast. And PCE is going to be sub 4% next month. And the Fed has this data.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. What we know is that the Fed feels it's been burned by prospectively banking on inflation numbers, and it's not going to do it again. Remember those big revisions in January kind of wiped out a progress we thought had happened in November, December, and January and February came in hotter than expected. It's possible. If you're arguing for a pause, Kelly, you can't rule it out.
I want cuts.
I would just say right now, the odds are that I think they hike right now, given all of the hawkish rhetoric I've heard.
Yeah.
The most neutral person so far has been Powell. It's kind of interesting.
It's true. And yet the market almost is discounting that somewhat, those remarks. Steve, thank you. We appreciate it. Our Steve Leisman reporting.
Pleasure.
The inflation, like Steve said, doesn't appear to be coming down as fast as the Fed would like. Could one of the problems be corporate profits? Take a look at this recent headline in the Wall Street Journal. McDonald's, Pepsi, and GM flex their pricing power because the companies are able to keep pushing through price hikes. So is inflation sticky because of supply and demand or because of corporate greed? Joining me now for that debate are Isabella Weber, Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and Michael Falkender, Dean's Professor of Finance at the University of Maryland. Welcome to both of you. Professor Weber, you think it is some corporate profits are being the culprit here. Why?
Yeah, so I think corporate profits have played an important role. I wouldn't project that on a sudden increase in corporate greed, because the role of profits is always, the goal of firms is always to pursue profits. But what we have seen is that these massive cost shocks have coordinated price hikes, that bottlenecks have presented an opportunity to increase prices, and that also consumers have been more willing to pay these higher prices, as in the context of the emergencies of war and pandemic, it seemed natural that prices would be going up. So they were more accepting of price increases than many would have thought.
Professor Falkender, what would you say about that?
Well, I would say I would just build upon what Steve just talked about in your previous report, which is that if consumers are out there looking to spend more money and businesses are out there looking to engage in greater investment, there's more demand. And yet we don't have sufficient supply. We've got labor shortages in our country. We have taken energy supplies offline. And so when you've got excess demand and insufficient supply, you're going to have an outcome where prices go up. Now, corporate profits do rise, but that's an outcome. It is not a cause, right? So when prices go up and you have an inability to bring on additional supply, the producers are going to generate higher profits. But I think it's important we distinguish between what is the cause and what is just an outcome. Because if we're going to make sure that things change, we need to go after the root causes.
Professor Weber, what about the fact that people point to and they say, well, the corporate profits have been increasing for, 10, 20, 30 years time? Or, they go up and down in, business cycles, but they seem to be kind of like ever steadily marching higher.
I mean, first of all, we have seen corporate profit margins reach levels that we haven't seen since the aftermath of World War II. So this is quite extraordinary. We have also seen profit margins in terms of their share in unit price that are around 34%, which is much higher than anything that we have seen in previous decades, including the 1970s when we had very high inflation. And this is according to reporting from the Wall Street Journal as of today. To the point of whether this is demand driven, I mean, on your show actually at CNBC, you have been talking about shrinkflation, right? And there is this phenomenon of prices over volume, where many corporations have been increasing prices even when volumes have been going down. These are household names like Pepsi, Procter & Gamble, Nestle, Unilever, and so on, which are all confidently saying that they have managed to increase prices when volumes were going down. If prices were going up due to demand, I would expect that volume is going up and not down. So clearly, what corporate leaders are saying on the profit on the earnings calls that they can take pricing and that they have more pricing power than they thought they would is something that we should be taking seriously, and that is playing a role in explaining the return of inflation.
What would you build on that, Professor Falkender? I mean, do you think we should see volumes rising with prices if this is demand-driven inflation?
It depends upon whether it's simultaneous with a supply shortage. Right. So if you've got an insufficient number and you've simultaneously got higher demand, then you're going to have lower volumes at higher prices. And I think it's also important to go back to identifying when the inflation began. There was a significant shift in monthly CPI numbers in March of 2021. And what did that perfectly coincide with? It came with an extra $2 trillion being thrown into the economy in an economy that was already coming out of the pandemic. So we had way too much fiscal stimulus at a time that there were supply shortages. And so if you have those two things simultaneously take place, you can see volumes decline and prices still go up.
And Professor Weber, we got to go, but it does sound like corporations are turning more cautious now. We're hearing Restoration Hardware just in the past 24 hours saying we're going to have to do more price cuts to clear margin. As the cycle turns, could you see those corporate profits very quickly go away?
They could go away, but we also have to see that many corporate leaders are saying that as costs are going down for energy, for transportation and so on, for raw materials, that this could actually, for some corporations, create a new round of windfalls where if they can't keep prices where they are, costs going down, margins might in some cases go up again.
All right. That's the condition we will watch for. Thank you both for your time today. And to a holiday weekend, no less, we appreciate it. Isabella Weber and Michael Falkender. Still ahead, another voice on the inflation debate. The IMF out with a new report urging the Fed to remain hawkish in the fight against inflation. They see the Fed funds rate between 5.25% and 5.5% until late next year. We will speak with IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva in a first on CNBC interview. Coming up in the show, Dow's still up nearly 300 points. Don't go anywhere.
Good afternoon and welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson with your CNBC News update. A military veteran who stormed the U.S. Capitol with the Oath Keepers on January 6th was sentenced to 8.5 years in federal prison today. Jessica Watkins apologized and called her actions reprehensible. Her sentence came one day after Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes was sentenced to 18 years in prison for his role in the attack. Public safety officials warned California rivers fed by the massive snow belt in the Sierra Nevada mountains could be especially dangerous this holiday weekend. The region saw record snowpack this winter, and as it melts, it is leading to dangerous flooding and higher, faster river waters. Already this spring, 7 people have died or gone missing in the rivers out there. An ancient monument from the Olmec civilization was returned to Mexico today, decades after it was illegally removed from the country. The monument, known as the Gateway to the Underworld, was taken from Mexico in the 1950s. Experts believe it is around 2,500 years old and dates back to the mid-preclassic period between 800 and 4,000 BC. Kelly, back to you.
Very cool. See you soon, Tyler, for our special. Looking forward to it. Coming up is the mega rally in mega cap tech sustainable. We'll ask Evercore's Mark Mahaney about that. And the one name he says can still climb 25% from here. Which one is it of those? Can you guess? We're back after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. NVIDIA hitting another all-time high today, building on yesterday's 24% post-earnings bump, and that's pushing the SMH ETF to a 52-week high of its own. NVIDIA is not even the best performer in that group this week, by the way. It's Marvell, that chipmaker surging 27% today, and it's now up 38% since Monday. It also posted a big beat on the top and bottom lines last night. So is this the week that AI really becomes real for the market, or the week we'll remember the bubble taking off? That's the subject of today's Tech Check with Deirdre Bosa. Hi, Deirdre.
And Kelly, it is probably both of those things, but certainly it's also the week when dollars and cents, hard numbers, really started to matter in this AI hype cycle, if you want to call it that, when we no longer talk about the secular shift, but one that is happening in real time right in front of us. Bank of America this morning writes, NVIDIA pulled forward the substance of the theme and raised the bar. If your company still randomly saying AI on conference calls with no actual users, product, and revenue roadmap, the market will sniff you out. Enter Marvell's numbers. You just mentioned this, Kelly. Last night, it reported that AI revenue is expected to double this year. They put a number on it to $400 million. Notes generative AI is driving multi-year demand for custom silicon. 29% pop now today. On the other side of that equation, though, we are seeing artificial intelligence cost companies money, too. Microsoft, Amazon, Google, their cloud units, they need to upgrade servers and infrastructure on the back end so that their customers can run their own generative AI model. So, yeah, new opportunities for them, but it's also increasing their capital expenditures or CapEx at a moment when they're trying to be more profitable and disciplined. There's also the AI enablers, the Snowflakes, the C3AIs, the Databricks that specialize in data analytics. They should be the new infrastructure allowing companies to make use of their data to create models. Databricks CEO Ali Ghodsi told me earlier this week that the models are only as good as the data. So perhaps some urgency for those names to show that they're a real part of this story, as we saw with Snowflake's decline this week. The market, Kelly, was still looking at those disappointing numbers. I always come back to this chart here that you're looking at right now, too. You see, this is an analogy of what happened during the mobile internet era. First, it was the semiconductors that benefited. We're seeing that right now in the hype cycle for generative AI. Then it was infrastructure. In the mobile era, it was Samsung and Apple. Then you had software and services. We don't yet know what the green and blue is going to be, but if this follows the same kind of model, we're going to see those benefit later. Right now, we're certainly seeing sort of the nuts and bolts, the picks and shovels, the semiconductors benefit. What's going to come next? That's what the market's trying to figure out.
I love that. And it's fascinating that a lot of the same names are expected to benefit again. Yeah. You know, usually cycles are all different, and yet this one seems to involve a lot of the same players. Deirdre, thank you. Deirdre Bosa. Believe it or not, the NASDAQ is now up 23% year to date on the back of all these massive tech gains. And my next guest says the tech rally still has legs from a different subsector, the internet it's like the whole thing, but he's particularly bullish on one name in particular. Let's bring in Mark Mahaney, Evercore ISI's head of internet research. Mark, it's good to see you. So broadly speaking, why are you still bullish? You think it's AI or more than that or a different story entirely?
Well, thanks, Kelly, and happy Friday. This is we call this a triple trough thesis opportunity for Amazon. The stock has really underperformed for almost 2.5 years now. It's derated. In other words, its multiples come down for a variety of different reasons, but largely because margins have come under pressure and growth has dramatically slowed down. If you told me a few years ago that AWS was going to be growing 10, 11% in a quarter, I would have said sell everything, at least sell Amazon stock. Well, that's what happened. And so now the question is, what's the next call on the stock? We think there's an opportunity here for margins to rise. So we're saying the company, both on the retail and the AWS side, is at trough margins. And we think there's a chance for the revenue growth on both sides, the retail and the cloud side, AWS side, to reaccelerate. If we're right on that, we think the multiple will go up on the stock. And there's a nice pathway here to at least 20 to 30% upside. And if you want to get back to the prior multiple it had, you could have much more upside than that.
So they're, I think this is on the retail side, that their margin went from over 5% in 2018 to negative. Is that right?
That's right. Last year. Now, this was a company that was almost, I refer to it as macro squared. I mean, if there was an inflationary cost factor last year, it hit Amazon, fuel, shipping, labor, even input, source inputs, because like steel, because the company was dramatically expanding its infrastructure, building out a lot of distribution capacity. So it just got waylaid by all these inflationary costs last year. So you're starting to moderate against that. If we get a little bit of recovery in revenue growth as consumer discretionary comes back, it will. Whether it's the second half of this year, first half of next year, it's somewhere in there, that 12 to 18 month time frame. As that comes back, that should rise margins. And then this was also a company that probably way overbuilt. They overextrapolated from COVID. So you've got this capacity utilization issue. But as they slow down their CapEx on their retail infrastructure and demand comes back, you get capacity utilization going up, margins will go up.
So we've seen big tech be able to switch the narrative on a dime, witness Meta, some of the others. Microsoft and Google have ChatGPT. Meta just did massive cost cuts. Does Amazon need to do something similarly, kind of attention grabbing to signal to investors it's at this inflection point, it knows how to drive results to get that margin back on an upward trajectory? And if so, what is that?
Kelly, I think probably the single biggest thing that the market is going to want to see out of Amazon is this reacceleration in AWS revenue growth. So those four kind of levers, retail revenue, AWS revenue, retail margins, AWS margins, is probably the AWS revenue growth. Look, it's decelerating by, more than anybody would have thought 2 or 3 years ago. No question about it. Now, can it start reaccelerating? Well, in part, that's a macro recovery call, but it's also we're going through this optimization cycle where a lot of companies probably overbought cloud over the last couple of years. So those contracts are being renegotiated. That's a 12 to 18 month cycle. And then there's the AI workloads. Look, if AI is taking off, if generative AI and large language models are going to become kind of commonplace or, broadly disseminated across digital companies and physical companies too, that's going to be stored somewhere and it's going to be powered somewhere. The compute power and the storage capabilities, I think AWS is a real shot of being one of the biggest winners off that. Sure. I don't think that's reflected in the stock, but it should show up in the numbers. We should see this reacceleration in AWS revenue growth. That's what the market's waiting for.
All right, calling it here. Before you go, Mark, I want to ask you about Netflix, because yesterday the stock was under pressure and the kind of word on the street was that the password sharing crackdown is, a huge problem or not going well. Well, today the stock's up 6%. Year to date, it's up 28%. What, if anything, do we know at this point about its crackdown and how that might be going?
Well, two things. I'm sorry, password crackdown is essentially a price increase. I have three dependents, three, from college and boarding school that are using my Netflix password, the Mahaney Netflix password. So I'm either going to, have to cut them off or I'm going to have to pay more. And I think there are other people like me out there. And so, for us, it is a password. It is a price increase. And that's where you're going to see that first order churn impact because people don't like price increases. But then what I think is going to happen is you're going to see more of these password sharers or borrowers start to pay for their own accounts. And that's what our survey work has kind of indicated across three countries across the last 6 months, that you're going to see 20-30% of those borrowers sign up for their own accounts because it's a compelling value proposition, especially now that Netflix is out there charging you $6.99 a month, the cost of a extra large latte at most places, $6.99 a month for all of Netflix. So that's my guess as to what's going to happen, a little bit of chop in terms of the churn. It will get through it and we'll see the sub ads sort of accelerate and the revenue base accelerates. And I think investors are anticipating getting beyond that churn bump.
Yeah, no, it's a notable pop today, so I wanted to mention it. By the way, my small coffee is approaching $6. It's some point I'm starting to think, I don't even finish it. Maybe this isn't worth it. Mark, thank you so much. We appreciate it today.
Thanks, Kelly.
Mark Mahaney with Evercore ISI. Still ahead, the U.S. will avoid a recession and the Fed can't back down in the inflation fight. Those two big headlines coming out of a new IMF report. Managing Director will join us live in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back. The IMF just out with a new report on the U.S. economy, urging the Fed to stay hawkish in its fight against inflation. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva just wrapped up a press conference on this very report, and she joins us now in a first on CNBC exclusive interview with our very own Sarah Eisen. Welcome to both of you, Sarah.
Hi, Kelly. Thank you. And Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon first.
Great to be with you, Sarah.
So I'm going through the report, hot off the press. Feels like one big headline here is that you say the U.S. will manage to avoid recession. And I'm just curious how you get to that conclusion, given all of the tightening we've had so far from the Fed.
Well, what we have seen from the data is that consumer demand is resilient. It is now being boosted by what comes from the strong labor market, and it is increase in incomes. This is, of course, excellent for households, and this is the foundation on which we project fourth quarter growth in 23 of 1.2%. And we expect this growth momentum to continue in 24, provided risks are well managed. Now, the flip side of this positive story is that inflation is stubborn. Yep. It is way too high vis-a-vis the Fed's target. And that, in our view, means that the Fed will have to keep interest rates higher for longer, all the way into 2024. We think that interest rates around 5.25% to 5.5% is what would be needed to cool down inflation and put it on the desired track to target.
So it sounds like not only do you recommend those rates stay high for longer, but it sounds like you think they're not done raising rates, that there's more work to do here?
Well, that is what we see, that the picture, including what we got today in PCE data, is that it might be necessary to get a notch higher and then stay a little longer than we initially projected to bring inflation down. You should also pay attention to is that our projection for unemployment is that it would go slowly up to 4.5%. 4.5% unemployment is still a very strong labor market. And that is why we come up with this duality of messaging. One, growth is good. Two, inflation is not. It needs rates to stay higher for longer.
Your view on the Fed path is a little bit different than the markets. And in part, the market seems inflation coming down faster. And what we're getting from some of these companies, Costco was the latest last night, is that it is moderating sharply. Even the housing companies talk about house prices coming down, and then there's the worry about the bank stress and the impact of credit tightening. So all of that is to say that the market appears more worried about over-tightening than under-tightening, and you appear to be worried about the opposite.
Well, I would be thrilled if the markets are right. But so far, they have gone into this expectation that we won the fight against inflation a couple of times, and that has not really quite happened yet. And what we are looking into is the strength of consumer demand fueled by two things. One, the fact that we have some increase in income, and so the pent-up demand from COVID may be exhausted, but there is a new fuel coming from the tight labor markets and how they impact wages. And two, while we're seeing some cooling of the property market, because majority of current homeowners have rates that are fixed, mm-hmm. this is not pushing down consumer demand as it would have done if we were in a world of flexible rates. So new buyers are less eager to step forward, but the existing homeowners are still enjoying the privilege of low interest rates. And that, of course, very often is a big determinant as to what people decide to spend. So they're employed, they have income that is going up, and they are not too pressed with mortgage payments.
Kristalina, it's Kelly here. I was going to literally ask what Sarah just asked, and that answer was very helpful for those who are more concerned about the hard landing. So I just want to ask one inflation question about Europe in particular. Why is food inflation so bad? In the UK, in Germany, we're talking about 20% price increases over the past year. You know, some say it's corporate greed, some say it's fertilizer prices that stem from the energy crisis, but that seems to be a major sticking point. When is it going away, and is it idiosyncratic? In other words, are you going to tighten in response to something that's not, you know, macro?
Yeah. Well, there are three reasons why Europe is, in terms of inflation, where it is. One, ECB has stepped up rate increase later than the Fed. Here, we are already benefiting from quite some time of the Fed bringing interest rates up. Two, Europe was hammered by the impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine much more severely, especially in terms of energy. This is not the case for the United States. And three, what we see in Europe is a higher impact of food prices. We are still unpacking why is that so. But it is potentially linked to the impact of energy prices, of gas prices on fertilizers and from there on agricultural production. Mm-hmm. We also have in Europe, in many countries, automaticity of increase in wages when inflation picks up. So not in all countries, but in quite a number of countries in Europe, this is the case. Different, very different from the United States.
So you're releasing this big report on the U.S. at a time where we're on pins and needles waiting for a debt ceiling deal, unfortunately, again, taking it down to the wire. We hope for mm-hmm. a deal, but in case there isn't, what does that look like for the U.S. bond market, the dollar, the global economy? How do you model out worst case scenario here?
Well, let me first say that I fall in the category of those that think that in the 12th hour, a solution would be found, but also in the category of those who would say, hey, we have enough problems as it is. This is completely self-inflicted injury. Why don't we take it away? For the world economy, we get into uncharted territory. Let's remember what the treasury market is. This is an anchor to the whole global financial system. You de-anchor the global economy, you push this ship on which we are into not only choppy waters, but uncharted waters. And the implications are going to be dramatic. They would be also dramatic for the United States. I want to make a point from our report, which is the U.S. should get rid of this artificial problem mm-hmm. that needs to be solved. It is logical to have appropriations once approved, defining how much the U.S. should borrow on the basis of this approval. So hopefully, at some point, people would say, we are in a world of more exogenous shocks, more problems. Let's check one of these problems out.
The other thing we're wondering, and there's about to be an AI special here on CNBC, is what the implications are going to be for AI on the U.S. economy, the U.S. labor force, on productivity. Have you begun looking at that? Some people are wondering if that's what helps us escape a recession. Yeah. We've certainly seen it help the market lately.
We certainly are looking into that. And like everybody else, we are saying this thing is moving so fast that we risk to fall behind. We are analyzing both the positive impact that is going to create the advancements so many areas of the economy. We are also looking at the risks. Our broad conclusion is that we need to be much more proactive in defining how we are tapping into opportunities, how we are managing the risks. At this point of time, this is left in the hands of a small number of companies. These are good people. They mean well for the world, but it shouldn't be just that small group defining our collective future. You know that the fears are gigantic. You also know that the expectations for benefits are huge, and everything is in between. At the front, we are looking systematically into positives, negatives, and how to manage this.
Well, we look forward to that report when it's out. It's going to be a juicy one. Kristalina Georgieva, fresh off of that Article 4 report on the U.S. economy, thank you for the time today.
Thank you.
Kelly, back over to you.
Thank you both. Really appreciate it. A newsy Friday afternoon. A quick check in the markets as well. Dow's up 287 points, so we are just off session highs. Two-day rally now that puts us in a much better position for the week. You can see nearly 1% gain for the blue chips. The S&P is up 1.2%, right on the nose at 4,200. One of these psychological levels we'll be watching closely. The NASDAQ, by the way, up 2% on what continues to be a strong AI and tech-led rally. That does it for The Exchange today.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.